SEJ has an annual conference every year. The last one was in Boise, Idaho, and they decide where their conferences are going to be a good year or two in advance. At every conference, there is an academic host. This year, the academic host was the University of Pennsylvania. So we had some of the conference taking place at the Annenberg Centers on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, and then some on a nearby hotel, which is where many of the conference participants stayed. About actually a year before the conference, they start looking for people to be co-hosts. They like getting co-hosts from the area that they're going to be holding the conference in, and they offered me that slot, and I was delighted to take it. I must confess, the implication I had was that it would only be about an hour a week until about 2 months before the conference. Oh, that is so not the truth. It was actually a lot of work, but it was also great to be elbow deep in developing the conference because I began to appreciate all the work that environmental journalists are doing. And in a funny sort of way, it was a great to the occasional despair that befalls all of us as journalists, either because the work we do in a general sense in journalism is not listened to and respected for the fact-finding that it is. And then specifically in the area of environmental journalism, there are any numbers of people, organizations, businesses who want to poo the ground truths of climate change and what it means to our country and the world. Having some up-close knowledge of the smarts of the people that are part of this organization was really it lifted me up, I think, a bit. There were over 1,000 journalists at the conference. The conference is largely made up, composed by the SEJ journalists themselves. As we go through this, like all of the panels are suggested by SEJ journalists. Now, there were something like 135 panels suggested by journalists, and part of my job with obviously working with other people who are very familiar with conferences, with SEJ's conferences, was to whittle that down to about 30 panels. So that was an extraordinary task because, honestly, when it comes to a panel on hydrogen and whether the hydrogen is really going to help us with our climate change problems, or is it an expensive boondoggle that sort of takes your eyes off the prize? In order to understand what that panel might present and who its presenters might be, I had to do some research on hydrogen and get a little bit more up to speed on it because, I think you know, there's a hydrogen proposed for southeast Pennsylvania and northern Delaware. It's one site, but it's also many sites linked in together. So it was important for me to learn more about that. I found as I was going through, there was a lot of work to educate myself on what the panels could be and what would work, but it was also linked up with the fact that there were so many people who were already knowledgeable about this and were doing their best to supply all our readers and listeners with as much up-to-date and accurate information as possible. That was terrific. So we had, as our co-host, as I said, the University of Pennsylvania. And like one of the big overarching themes for this conference was the dangers of mis- and disinformation, especially in this election year and also generally with the onslaught of mis- and disinformation that can flood the zone about anything to do with climate change or sustainability. And there we had two real experts, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who's the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at Penn, and she is a co-founder of factcheck.org. That's been up and running for quite a few years now. They try as best as possible to check what politicians say and to say, is it true or is it fictitious, right? So she is particularly valuable for all of us who are involved in journalism. And then the other person who is a key person, part of our conference, was Michael E. Mann, who is the director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media. So he is an expert on climate change and is a science who has a list as long as your arm of books and articles and peer-reviewed stuff. But you might have heard of him because most scientists, when they are given a bad name by these bad actors who want to say that they're lying, he took action. In February of this year, a civil trial jury in Washington found that Mark Stein and the Competitive Enterprise Institute blogger Rand Simberg defamed and injured climatologist Michael Mann in blog post. The jury awarded Mann $1 in compensatory damage from each writer. It awarded punitive damages of $1,000 from Simberg and $1 million from Stein after finding that the pair made their statements with, quote, maliciousness, spite, ill will, vengeance, or deliberate intent to harm. And Michael Mann is among those scientists who are feeling like it's time to get the boxing gloves on and to fight back when people say that what they're saying is untrue. And this was a pretty famous decision that this court took. And so on the very first day of the conference, we have day-long workshops. And one of the day-long workshops is on that mis- and disinformation that we as journalists need to be on guard for with the election and with the advent of AI.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to the publisher of Delaware Currents, talking about the conference that Meg McGuire just came from, the Society of the Environmental Journalists Conference that happened in Philadelphia. So, Meg, what else happened at this conference?
Another workshop on that day was devoted to the policy and practice of looking after two watersheds, the Delaware, our own beloved Delaware, and our neighbor, the Susquehanna, and comparing and contrasting the governance of those watersheds, which is a workshop I would have been delighted to attend, but because of my co-host duties, I was busy running around all over the place, and so I didn't actually end up attending that. Or another fabulous thing that happens in SEJ is we have all-day tours. Buses fan out from, in this case, Philadelphia, going as far as 2 hours away to see some grassroots reality that affect this part of the world. There was a bus that went down to the Chesapeake Bay and talked with experts there about, despite the fact that the Chesapeake Bay has had an ongoing programs to limit the pollution problems, it still has problems. Then another bus went west to learn about Pennsylvania's fossil fuel legacy. Then closer to our part of the world, there was a bus that came up to the Delaware Water Gap and discussed the Tox Island Dam, discussed the taken land from the Indians, and discussed some of the ideas for what might happen to the DWGNRA. And then, of course, the watershed extends way down to the Delaware Bay, and there was a tour that explored the New Jersey side of Delaware Bay and another tour that explored the Delaware side of the Delaware Bay. And then there was another tour that stayed a little closer in sort of Philadelphia, Chester, Camden, and I think Wilmington, that took a deep dive into what are called fence line communities. That's become a shorthand to talk about those communities that are immediately adjacent to highly polluting facilities like fossil fuel infrastructure, industrial parks, or large manufacturing facilities, and that community is directly affected by traffic noise operation and, of course, chemical and fossil fuel emissions of the operation. And one of the things that we have discovered over the last 10 years of doing all this work, these fence line communities are very largely African American. They are also lower socioeconomic class. So that's a way that industry and perhaps even government takes advantage of people who don't have the wherewithal to fight back, who don't really know what might be coming down the pike with this fenced-in area that's just down their block. So it's one of the things that environmental journalists are becoming more and more sensitive to, that we find out what's there and then help the community understand what is coming and what they can do about it. And then another tour went out to the New Jersey shore, which is a little outside the watershed, but talking about energy in the east, offshore wind, LNG, and this difficult question of who gets to say no to energy development. Because, once again, we're very often places that get developed for energy development are these fence line communities? How can we help them not just get dumped on? And so there was 10 of these tours that went out. They went out all day. There were one bus broke down. Somebody else got caught in a huge traffic snarl. So it was it became quite an adventure for, let's see, 10 buses, and there was probably 30 people on each bus. So it was quite a number of people that started dragging back to Philly at anywhere from about 4:30 to about 7:30. But they all seemed to have a great time. I think one of the things that's changed a little in environmental journalism coverage, even in the time that I've been running Delaware Currents, which, good Lord, it's almost 9 years now, there was a time when environmental journalists were very concerned, they still are, about the big stories. What is the federal government doing? What is the international community doing? What are we going to do about, oh, yeah, remember the ozone layer? That was a really big deal. So it was these really big mega stories, and sometimes maybe not nearly enough of the local stories, of the grassroots story. And I think what's happened now is that most people are realizing, no matter where you live, there are some effects of climate change, right? Whether it's invasive species or, in our neck of the woods, certainly flooding is an issue. So all of these things are happening at a much more local level. When the SDJ conference folks fan out in our area, they're discovering what those local stories are for us, and then seeing how, whether if they're from Montana or Indiana or Ohio, what are the stories that they could write about that perhaps will inform their communities? And what can they listen to hear the voice of the local communities that are experiencing these problems? And so it's a lot, it's like the whole environmental journalist community has become much more attentive to those local effects and therefore writing stories about local effects. And it is, I think, those local effects that are, in a way, our undisputed proof that climate change is real and happening. So it's nice to have those effects to fall back on. On Friday, mm-hmm. we had the EPA agency, EPA's administrator, Michael Reagan, in for a speech and a very lively Q&A, as you can quite imagine, because it was obviously all the questions came from the environmental journalist, and I took copious notes about that. But of the many things he said stuck with me. But I think the most noteworthy might be that science is slow, but the development of new ways to harm the environment is much quicker, right? It's almost industry invents something, some new thing, right? They have, however their R&D long takes them, there is no BPS wait till that thing is actually out, being used, and in the environment. And then they have to go and track it all down because science is painstaking and detail-oriented. That's one of the reasons why, even though we've all been getting very concerned about the effects of PFAS and the whole family of nasty stuff that's related to that, we've only had federal regulations on that in the past few weeks, even though it's probably been 10 years that we've been aware that there's a problem. So science is slow. Finding the truth is slow. Finding the facts is slow. And it lends, I think, credibility to this side of the conversation when their rules and regulations are based on scientific investigation. He also pointed something that I didn't know. The Supreme Court in 2023 had a decision in a case called Sackett versus the Environmental Protection Agency. And the Supreme Court, in its decision, took a hammer to the Clean Water Act. And what the EPA has learned from that decision is that the Supreme Court can act beyond the specific details of a case, the Sackett case. And if the EPA has to be mindful not to do too much in their rulings, to make sure their rulings are narrow enough so that if someone wants to take them to court on it, the Supreme Court doesn't have an excuse to upend other things. In this particular case, the court went further than the ruling in question, and they stripped federal protections from countless wetlands and left those critical ecosystems exposed to devastating pollution and other damage from agriculture and other industries. There's really a, they can't act fast and they can't act broad. And that's the only sort of way forward, which was disconcerting, I think, for me. Then Saturday and Sunday, right, were what I would call regular conference days. There was panels on wildfire smoke. There were panels on data visualization. I already mentioned the panel that was on hydrogen. There was one on how can environmental journalists more fairly represent rural communities, which I thought of. Certainly in our watershed, there's plenty of rural communities in the northern end of the watershed. There was plenty of panels on a various aspect of the climate crisis, but especially on global migration. We don't see a lot of it in this country, but certainly in the third world, that's starting to have an enormous impact. There was another panel on how to track the money from Biden's Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure bill. This big money stuff is available, but how it trickles down into communities is through a fairly convoluted structural mechanism, which is already in place. For example, these various state departments that have the lending authority, so they receive the money and then they hand out the money as low-interest loans to communities that need them. But we as journalists want to try and track that stuff because there are certainly all sorts of needs in our communities, and we want to make sure that some of that money is getting to where the need is greatest, not just to where they have enough staff to do all the paperwork that you need to do before you can actually get your hands on any money. So I thought that was an important one. On Saturday night, there was a dinner dance party at a place called Brooklyn Bowl. The original Brooklyn Bowl is in, surprisingly, Brooklyn. Now, I can't tell you anything about that because by Saturday night, I was done. So I ended up staying and just revising all my notes and stuff. And then Sunday, the last day, we had presentations by various authors that are part of SEJ who have published books in the last year. And we went on a tour of the John Hines National Wildlife Refuge just south of Philadelphia. And then it was done.
Now, you said there were over 1,000 journalists have attended this event. What was the mixture? Was it a mixture of those working in the field currently, or a mixture of college students, those in grad students, or was this all seasoned journalists?
It was, I think, largely journalists working in the field. Because we don't have a lot of very deep pockets, it's hard for very often for students to get to the conference. We did have students from the Philadelphia area, both undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduates, because if you live within traveling distance of the conference, then you only pay, I think if you're a student, it's $25 a day to attend the conference. So there were certainly people, local people, who were able to take advantage of it. There are also SEJ scholarships for folks. I was involved in getting some fellowships for people who live further away, also involved in getting some fellowships for people, DEI, EJ, sort of people who the world of environmental journalism has been a little more on the white side than is appropriate. And so trying to get enough support for people of color to be active participants in the world of environmental journalism is really important to all of us. There was about 40 fellowships from different areas. One of the big funders for some of these fellowships was the William Penn Foundation, which is an organization that funds environmental work in the watershed. And I should also note, to be as transparent as possible, William Penn, bless their hearts, also provide me with some funding.
You said in the beginning, I just want to go back onto this point that you mentioned in the beginning of the interview, that how sometimes environmental journalists aren't taken seriously. Is that what you said in the beginning?
Not so much seriously. I think it's more that people want to find fault with their facts. You're familiar with this, that if you report something that a business doesn't like, they often say that you're wrong or misinformed or whatever. And that certainly has been the case with the problems with climate change, that environmental journalists have been doing stories about the climate change and what it means to us, honestly, for 25 years, maybe more. But more, I think more and more people are understanding that, yes, climate change is a real thing and it's happening. But when environmental journalists were first writing about it, there were all sorts of people who said that it was wrong, that the facts were wrong, that there was no proof, that there's just a whole panoply of ways they thought they could essentially argue against the facts that journalists were presenting. But I think that ship has sailed. Although one of the things that, I can't even remember where it was, I think it might have been in one of the panels, one of the ways that the people who are still dragging their feet about taking appropriate action about pollution and climate change often then turn that whole science is slow thing on its head and say, we haven't had a conclusive answer to this, so we should wait and wait. And in the meantime, they're doing more and more of the practice that it harms the environment and harms the people who live in proximity to wherever they're doing their thing. So this is where this the idea of mis and disinformation comes from, sort of being able, oh, and the other one of the other things is greenwashing. You might have heard of this, where a company wants to pretend that they're big supporters of sustainability and they are big fighters of the climate crisis, but when you dig down deep into what they're doing and where they're doing it, that is often not the case. So that's another misinformation that we as journalists need to understand that is out there. Because the thing is, many of the people who are employed by these businesses that are not doing right by the environment, they're really smart, and they have lots of time and resources to develop whatever misinforming platform they might think would work. And in an era that we live in, where journalists often don't have that level of resources, as most newsrooms have seen drastic reductions. Back a million years ago, when I worked at the News Times in Danbury, we had an environmental reporter on our staff. It was a 35,000 circulation paper. We had an environmental reporter on our staff. And every newsroom, it would be great if every newsroom still had that. But that newsroom that had maybe 30 people on its staff probably now has 4 or 5. The newsroom that I was in our neck of the woods at the Times-Herald Record in Middletown, when I was managing editor there, we had about 150 full-time equivalents. Now they have 10. How can journalists who are so crunched for resources find the right sort of time to dig into these stories that are put forward by well-funded, smart outfits, which it becomes, it's a little bit of a David and Goliath story, but rather than getting upset about it, as I sometimes do, I felt like when I was actually at the conference, I suddenly realized, my God, there's an army of environmental journalists trying to fight the good fight, and that made me feel good.
That actually was going to be my next question. While the information was great and while everything else is in the conference great, I think what really comes out of these conferences, in my experiences when I attend journalist conferences, is the networking, meeting other people in the field. I know as a journalist, when I first started going out to the field, and sometimes you feel like you're working in a sort of a bubble of your newsroom and seeing the folks that you normally see. Sometimes you feel like you're working alone, especially in a small newsroom. But when you go to, I mean, when I went to my first conference, I was like, wow, there's other people out there like me, other people having the same experiences. While they may live, one journalist lives in Long Island, the other one lives in Connecticut, they're still dealing with the same things, covering board meetings, and some of the issues are the same. So when I attended it and I left my first conference, I remember it motivated me to do better.
That's right. Yep, very much so. The unfortunate thing, though, now is that many of the journalists who came to the conference, I said that newsrooms have shrunk. One of the positions in most newsrooms that have been gotten rid of over the past 10, 15 years are those environmental journalist positions. So many of those environmental journalists have become freelancers. Freelancers don't have all the money in the world to go to conferences, right? Once upon a time, the newsroom that you were part of would often pay some or all of the bill for you to go to a conference. Now that happens less because there are more and more of the journalists that attended this conference were freelancers, and it's one of the reasons why I was so impressed by their attendance. We had, not only did we have people from all over this country, they were people from Canada, there were people from South America, and there was a person who worked on an investigative newspaper in Nigeria, and he was there. It's just, it's rejuvenating to have, to understand that there are people in all corners of the world who are trying to fight the good fight.
Yeah, no.
Absolutely. Meg, that was fantastic. I felt like I was there. We were talking to Meg McGuire, publisher of the Delaware Currents, about her recent trip to Philadelphia for this special conference, the SEJ conference, Annual Conference for Environmental Journalists. Thank you so much, Meg, for talking to me about this conference. And again, congratulations on being one of the co-hosts and organizers and running around and making sure everything was going good and attending the different breakout rooms there. So again, thank you so much for talking to me. I do really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, it was terrific. Thanks very much for the call, Patricia.